I'm Christopher Lydon in podcast conversation with Timothy Snyder, the Yale historian who makes waves. Black Earth is his big new interpretation of the Holocaust as history and warning. His argument, for starters, is that the record of killing Jews, when, where, why, how, is in many ways unlike the story we've absorbed about the 20th century's most awful catastrophe. If we Americans knew the basics about Hitler, he's saying, we wouldn't be repeating many of his blunders in the 21st century. Specifically, we would not have initiated the decapitation and destruction of states as in Iraq and Libya. We would not have provoked the zombification of helpless populations that are now at the mercy of ISIS. If we really wanted to drive a stake in the heart of the Hitler vision, Tim Snyder is telling me, we might well be unleashing science on the climate crisis and on the deep panic about food supplies in the long run, which he says Hitler anticipated in his own mad way in Mein Kampf. Tim Snyder held an overflow crowd breathless at the Harvard bookstore the other night. We had our own long gab with him about his facts and their meaning today. First, here's a taste of his bookstore opening, and then some of our conversation.
In this book, I'm very much unconcerned with how we remember the Holocaust and very much concerned with trying to explain how it actually happened. Now, insofar as we do have an account, a causal account of the Holocaust, it rests on a story. And one of the things I mean to do in this book, I mean to do with you here tonight, is to try to show how this story does not, in fact, make any sense at all, how it cannot serve as an adequate explanation. What is this story? It's fair to say that most of us think that the Holocaust was a result of an increasingly repressive German state, an authoritarian regime classifying its Jewish citizens, discriminating against them, seizing its property, putting them in camps where they were later killed. Now, the problem with this story is that it's mostly false, and the parts of it that are true are entirely inadequate to explain the phenomenon. The vast majority of Jews who died in the Holocaust had nothing to do whatsoever with Germany until the German policy of killing arrived. 97% of the Jews who died in the Holocaust were not citizens of Germany. 97%. Or if that number doesn't strike you, how about these? When the Holocaust starts, the percentage of Jews who live in Germany is about 0.25%. 0.25% of the German population. Or to look at it yet another way, if you were a Jew in Germany, your chances of surviving the Holocaust were about 50-50, which is horrible, but which is much, much better than the zone where the Holocaust actually took place. Which brings me to the next thing, which we must understand, must begin from. So what I'm trying to do is start from the basic facts, right? We must begin from a basic bit of geography. Where the Holocaust happened, it did not happen in pre-war Germany. Jews were not killed in pre-war Germany in any significant numbers, even German Jews. If a German Jew was to be killed, he or she had to first be taken out of pre-war Germany and shipped somewhere else. Where? Well, to the east. And in most memoirs, or even histories of the Holocaust, which are based almost entirely only on German language sources, the East is a mysterious land full of nothing except dark mystery and eventually death. But the East, for the purposes of an attempted analysis, is a place where Jews had lived, right? Where most European Jews, and indeed most of the Jews of the world, had lived for about half a millennium. Where there were other states which, for better or worse, had supported, allowed Jewish societies to maintain themselves. What happens, and the main factor that I think that has been ignored, what happens is that all of these states are destroyed. They're removed from the map. The entire Holocaust, all of the killing of the Holocaust, happens in a zone which German power, sometimes with the help of Soviet power, sometimes not, which German power has made stateless. The entirety. Most of the Jews who die live in this place, and almost all of the other Jews who are going to die have to first be moved into this place, okay? Another elementary fact, which is worth considering, is chronology. If we want to think that the Holocaust was a matter of the German Jews and the German state and authoritarianism and so on, we have to ask ourselves, why was there no Holocaust in Germany between 1933 and 1941? because there was not. The German regime never found a way to kill Jewish citizens in any significant numbers on its own territory. The Holocaust begins in 1941, which is a very significant moment. It's the moment of the great projection of German racial power to the East, the invasion of the Soviet Union. So everything, the numbers, the geography, and the chronology militate against the narrative of the Holocaust that we have.
That was Tim Snyder's Harvard Bookstore beginning. In conversation with me, Tim Snyder retold his Hitler story for the implications forward to the present day, about food and climate, about long wars and states and state destruction.
The story has to start from the basic facts.
But let's go to the heart of your argument about Hitler. You call him an anarchic warmonger with a global vision of racial struggle for nature. And the big argument is that the stake has never been driven through the heart of that vision, a fight for land and existence in an ecology of scarcity. Do I have it roughly right?
Yeah, you've got it absolutely right. Hitler's a child of globalization, just like we are. We live in this age of globalization, and, you know, because we're dumb Americans, we think it's never happened before. But it has. This is the second globalization. The one that started in the 1870s and ended, let's say, with the Holocaust is the first one. This is the second one, the one that started in the 1970s and which is going through some rocky moments right now. Hitler's way of thinking, whether we like it or not, was a perfectly coherent response to globalization. It has two parts. The first part says you have to take what you can, because there are greater powers out there and they're setting rules, and those rules are all artificial. You have to break those rules. You have to take what you can. This is the argument for Lebensraum, the thing which I call ecological panic. It says the only thing which is real is scarcity. The only reasonable reaction is struggle. And if you can take it away from someone else, that means you should. It means they're inferior. And the second part is to say these rules of global trade, these rules of ethics, of religion, doesn't matter, social contract, legal contract, it's all the same for Hitler. These rules are artificial. They come from Jews. The Jews are the people who made up these rules. And if we get rid of the Jews, if we can purge them from our minds, then we can move back to a normal way of treating the world.
The rules being roughly, as I read you, the rules of law and of ethics. He would say it's a jungle struggle and those things cannot apply.
Yeah. All of them. I mean, when you say that the stake hasn't been driven through the heart of this, you're absolutely right. What we do with Hitler is we say, okay, we know authoritarians. This is just an authoritarian, but more so. Or we know nationalists. This is just a nationalist, but more so. But that's not the case. It's not a linear phenomenon. It's not a quantitative issue where, you know, oh, I know Saddam Hussein and Hitler is Saddam Hussein times two. No. Hitler was not a nationalist. He was a racial anarchist. He believed that we really were divided up into races and that the real history of the world, when it recommenced, would involve those races killing each other. He was not an authoritarian. He didn't care about the state per se. He understood that he needed the state in order to destroy other states to begin this anti-political purge, which would end in the restoration of nature. This is what he actually believed. And in order to get the history of the Holocaust right, one has to go all the way from those radical beliefs to the practices which allowed him to actually realize them. It's much broader than this, Chris. I mean, the Holocaust is exceptional in the sense that it's the only attempt to kill every member of a given group, to remove that group from the face of the planet. But a lot of what happens in the Holocaust is actually confirmed by other things we know from other episodes of ethnic cleansing or genocide. The social scientists who've been working on ethnic cleansing for the last 25 years have one basic finding, and that is that it correlates with state collapse. So what the Germans were doing, and this is what makes them special, is that they were deliberately engineering state collapse.
Right.
In places that didn't have to collapse in ever more violent ways, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, the Soviet Union. And as they did so, right, as they became better and better engineers of state collapse, they also became better and better entrepreneurs of violence, finding in deeper and deeper levels of chaos more and more ways to kill human beings. Now, what does that have to do with Iraq? I am not going to say that we went into Iraq with the same kinds of intentions. What I would say instead is that Iraq is exhibit A in half-blindly inverting the lessons of the Holocaust to suit your present convenience, right? If you think, oh, Hitler was just one more authoritarian and that caused the Holocaust, you could say, well, Saddam Hussein, he's an authoritarian, therefore he's terrible, but if you think what was specifically bad about Hitler was the anarchism, right, was the deliberate destruction of other states, believing that would lead to some kind of better political condition, then you might think twice about knocking over Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, right? I don't think that we deliberately did in Iraq the kinds of things that Hitler did in Poland, let's say, but I do think that we had screwed ourselves up to such a perfect misunderstanding of the Holocaust that we should be ashamed of ourselves, right? And that anyone, this now includes Russia and Ukraine as well, anyone who invokes the Holocaust as a reason to destroy somebody else's state is making, you know, a horrible, if not a willful mistake.
But it's a big deal argument in your book that the condition of the Holocaust was this double occupation of Poland. You know, first the Soviets smashed the shit out of it, and then let the Nazis go in and do it again. And that was specifically the context out of which the Holocaust idea, hey, this could work, and this is the place to do it. And in ISIS, you see, you know, a power structure that has been smashed by American weaponry. It's been displaced by Iran, too, and it's got all sorts of other guns pointed at it. And this is precisely the place where the modern madness is taking root, right? You said part of the whole structure of the Nazi logic was the globalizing of the enemy. It's not a few Jews, it's the Jews. It's the Jews everywhere. You know, and we've gone from, you know, a friend in Saddam to an enemy in Saddam to a kind of very real scary Islamophobia. It's Muslims. The business of sort of double occupation, globalize the enemy, is enough to make me suspect this is the way we should be looking at the present day.
Well, I think that's fundamentally right. I mean, it's a very simple argument. There have to be checks on globalization. I mean, the kinds of checks which make people feel comfortable and safe and content, you know, and not bloodily inclined to violence in their own locales, whatever those might be. The state is the only one we've got. I mean, there's the European Union, the main purpose of which, in my view, is to prop up states. The state is what we have. And as I see the way we analyze the 21st century, we've fallen into two traps on both the right and the left. On the right, we have this totally implausible story about how the market will throw up all the structures we need, therefore you should keep the state down and the market's mm-hmm. off. And on the left, we have this propensity not to talk about political structures anymore, but instead to focus on culture, right? And to imagine that questions of identity will somehow save us, which of course they won't. And so you have this underlying consensus between right and left, not only in the US, but also across the Atlantic as well, which leads to basically the state having no friends. And this has to do with how we've interpreted the Holocaust. We've interpreted the Holocaust backwards. Both the right and the left in their different ways say the problem was the state. For the left, it's the over-scientific classifying state. For the right, it's the welfare state, which supposedly became an authoritarian state, which supposedly became Nazism. Neither of those things even remotely happened. The historical record doesn't support those things. But the Holocaust, from which we should be drawing lessons, has been woven into these stories, which are anti-state stories. About ISIS, my rendering would be a little bit different. I would stress that the Iraq War, as you say, wiped out a state, alienated Ba'athist elites. You're absolutely right about that. It was foolish to criminalize their party without giving them anything to do. The Iraq War also drove 1.5 million Iraqis to Syrian cities, right, circa 2003, right. 2004, where they were joined by 1.5 to 2 million Syrian refugees during 3 years of consecutive drought. And there's the ecological part of what happens. That leads, among other things, to the Civil War. So there's an environmental aspect of this as well. And then, of course, there's Islam, all right? So let's think about Islam. There are the ideological components of radical Islam that we all know about and hear about every day. Fine, let's take that for granted. And then let's look at the objective situation. The whole Islamic world taken together, with the exception of basically Saudi Arabia, contributes almost nothing to the planetary change that we call global warming, right? And yet, they are going to be hit by it. They are being hit by it harder than anybody else and right away, right? The Nile can dry up. The drought in Libya is probably going to go from 100 days a year to 200 days a year. Mm. The floods in Pakistan are only going to get worse, right? That whole belt, whether it's more or less water, that whole belt is already getting hit in a way which we can't really even apprehend. How will Muslims react to that? I mean, how do you react to a world in which something is coming down on you from the outside, which is not actually your fault, which is making what is in fact your homeland desolate, right? Literally desolate, desertified. How do you react to that? I don't know the answer, but I don't imagine it's going to be anything particularly good. At the very least, let's put it this way. Let's consider Syria and the refugee crisis. Let's consider the weakening of the European Union. Let's consider the rise of the populist right in both Europe and the United States. What does that all have to do with? It has to do with the reality and the fears of south to north migration. Insofar as climate change continues and the Muslim world in particular becomes less and less habitable, even as Muslim birth rates continue to rise, where are these people going to go? They're going to go north. They're going to try to go north. And that's not going to have consequences that are particularly desirable.
What would a government with the right understanding of the Holocaust do about what everybody knows is a noxious regime in Syria?
Well, a government that had the right understanding of the Holocaust would look, and this is going to sound unbelievably boring to the point that it's dodging the question, but it's not. If we had the right understanding of the Holocaust in the West, we would care a lot more about the global environment than we do. We would sympathize might be the wrong word, but we would understand Germans who in the 1930s who had a powerful state, the ability to project power abroad, and perfectly real ecological anxieties, right? We would think this is a scenario we can hold off by working on desalinization of water, by working on climate control, right? If I'm right, and ecological panic is a big part of things like the Holocaust, then boring kinds of prevention would be something that all sound governments would be interested in doing. And there is actually some sign that the American government, at least the American presidential administration, is thinking along these lines. What else can you do about severely bad governments if you're thinking about the Holocaust? Well, what you don't think is that knocking them over is necessarily going to lead to something else.
What would we have done, though, Tim, with Gaddafi in hindsight, where we did change the regime and brought on chaos?
Yeah. Well, I didn't think that was such a great idea, and it wasn't. I mean, the fact that the Holocaust happened doesn't mean that we can end all the evil in the world. And even if we follow, I mean, even if one understood it perfectly, that wouldn't lead to like a smooth earth with no problems. All I'm trying to do in this book is to prevent us from ourselves causing the worst sorts of things from repeating themselves. It's not a prescription for ending evil in the world. Hmm. I mean, what I'm trying to do in this book really is to take the basic facts, as all scholars of the Holocaust know them, and reconcile them to some kind of interpretation. So every scholar of the Holocaust or anyone who vaguely knows anything about the Second World War will know that the Holocaust took place almost entirely outside of Germany. 97% of the victims were not German Jews. Everyone who works in the Holocaust will know that the vast majority of the victims were killed in Poland, occupied Poland and the occupied Soviet Union, which I emphasize are precisely the places where Germany declared the state didn't exist and carried out particularly rapacious kinds of colonial policies. Those became the zones where Jews from the rest of Europe could be sent as well. Anyone who works on the Holocaust will know that the Holocaust started not because of the invention of gas chambers. It started because the Germans realized that the SS, together with the Wehrmacht and civilian occupation authorities and police and a large number of local collaborators, was actually able to organize mass killing. In the summer and the fall of 1941, they learned that. There was no plan, but they realized they could do it. One of the Einsatzgruppe commanders wrote back to Berlin, "We have here an opportunity, an unexpected opportunity to resolve the Jewish question." And that was by way of shooting. So half of the Holocaust takes place by shooting. Shooting is probably the more important technology over gassing, because it's the one that shows that mass killing is actually possible. Gassing was a technical improvement from the point of view of the Germans themselves. It meant they could involve fewer people. So by the time you get to Auschwitz in 1943-44, most of the Holocaust has already happened. Now, why does this all matter? Well, it matters for at least three reasons. One is that we've got the whole basic geography wrong, as you've already hinted. Landing on the beaches of Normandy didn't make that much difference to the Holocaust one way or the other. It was the Red Army which liberated those territories. And in that sense, they were the ones who stopped the Holocaust, although they didn't care about it. The second reason it's so important is that it asks the question of institutions. If you imagine, as many of us still do, that the Holocaust was something that happened because an oppressive German state discriminated against, classified, alienated, appropriated the property of German Jews, then you're thinking about the wrong things. I mean, that's a part of the story, but it's a relatively small part. Most of the killing is somewhere else, and it happens not where there's an authoritarian state, but where a racial state destroys other states. And that's a piece of the picture which has just gone totally missing, it's fair to say. The other thing which is important about this is that it de-roboticizes, it rehumanizes the entire process, because we see that people not so different than us were capable of killing other people not so different than us face-to-face with guns on the scale of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and millions. And that's important because the way that we treat Auschwitz or gas chambers in general is that we imagine them as a kind of machine where like no one bore any particular responsibility. This is part of Hannah Arendt's argument I don't like. No one bore any particular responsibility because there was just this lever and that button and this conveyor belt and so on. Even Auschwitz, of course, was much more human and brutal and direct than that. But when we understand that the Holocaust involved human beings shooting other human beings at close distances, then it helps us to ask the real question of how something like this could happen. Once we understand that the gas chambers were there after the Holocaust had begun, after humans had proven what they can do, then the entire setup looks different morally.
Tim Snyder, it's a fascinating book, an amazing set of arguments. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Tim Snyder's book is titled Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. Check out many more open source conversations at our site, radioopensource.org. Leave your comments, please, and subscribe to the flow of these conversations at iTunes. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.